There we go. All right.
Well, where do you want to?
Well, let's start with the foxes. What are your own memories of the foxes?
Well, my memories was when I was very young, maybe 5 or 6. My father, John Andrew, John D, we called him, and my uncle Fred. That's I had a brother Fred, but who was in foxes. But this is my uncle Fred. And Chester McClure and Colonel Danny McKinnon formed the Belmont Black Fox Company. And they built a ranch over here where there's houses now. And that was all, at that time, the fox pen had to be outside and it had to be preferably in the woods. And you, the pens were all quite big, maybe 15 feet square, that type of thing. And they dug a trench down in the ground, 4 feet, 3.5, 4 feet, all around the edge of it. And they put a mat in there, which the wire went down into the bottom, and then a mat went out 18 inches, so wire came in that width, all around. And the two were laced together. And then when it got above ground, the wire went again up 10 feet, about, and then an overhang went in, so that when the fox was let loose there, he could run up to the top, and the overhang had stopped him from going over, and if he dug down, he'd hit the mat in the bottom, and he couldn't get out, you know, couldn't dig himself out. And in that pen then, there was what we called the fox house, which was maybe 4 feet long, and just a little slanting roof that would lift up. And inside of that then there was another the den, which is a smaller box with just a hole like so, round hole.
About 8 inches round.
No, less than that.
Less than that.
Because it was to keep that's where the fox would have its litter. And there was a small hole just enough for him to get through into it. And there was always some bedding of some kind in there.
That was only the female that lived though, right?
Oh, no, the male. Well, at first you had to thought they had to have a male for every female. But that changed after a while, and they'd move a male around when the females came in heat in the spring of the year. They'd move the male from one to the other, so he was able to service several. Wasn't he lucky?
Well, it'd be the same idea, I guess, as when you're breeding horses or breeding cattle. You're looking for certain characteristics.
Yeah.
Is a male fox called a dog?
Well, no, just a male.
Just a male. Okay. I thought he was called a dog, and a dog fox, and the female was called a bitch.
Oh, well, you're talking dogs there.
Right. That's just dogs. That's not foxes.
I never heard that related to foxes. No.
Okay.
But the females would be bred in the spring, and gosh, I don't know now how long a period. Before they had their litter, it wasn't a long time. It was. Perhaps somebody else can tell you that. I've forgotten. I used to know, but.
Well, just getting back to the fence, would the foxes try and go up the fence?
Oh yes, they'd run right up to the top, and try to get out if they could. Oh yeah, and it was quite a job when you wanted to catch a fox, and the fox was loose in that big pen. The only way would take a couple of fellas, or three, and one of them, they'd herd the fox into a corner, and then he'd let him run by. You'd stand there, and when he went by, you tried to grab his tail. And if you were quick, you made it. And once you picked them up, then it was quite a trick to run your hand. Of course, they had tongs, which you could put over their neck. But if you didn't have tongs with you, you could, you know, work your hand down his back, around his neck, and then grab him by the neck. Because they could bite, mind you.
Were you ever bitten by a fox?
Oh, yes. And they can bite. They won't let. The only way you can, once they bite, the only way you can get your hand free is just let them go. You know, you can't pull your hand away. He'll hang on there, but if you let him go, he lets go then, of course.
And would you have to have a tetanus shot after you get you got bitten, or was there even?
Not then.
No one even bothered with that.
No. I don't know if they ever heard of it. No.
Isn't that incredible?
So about this ranch, they built a ranch over in the woods there, and it was across the pasture field then. And we had about, there was a guard fence put all around the whole thing first, and that guard fence would take in maybe 2-3 acres, depending on how big an operation you wanted to get into. And it was the same. There was the mat and the fence and the overhang all around. And then the pens were generally two pens back to back, but you had to keep the wire in the center. You had to keep it away far enough so one wouldn't poke a foot through and the other one grab it, you know. So you had to have, you know, upwards 10 inches or something, depending on the material you had to work with at the time of it. So these pens were all built and prepared, and there'd be a feedway, maybe only 3 feet wide, put a wheelbarrow through, and with your feet in it, and one or two, depending on how big an operation it was, that there had to be where you could go through and feed a pen on both sides. Hmm. So that was all prepared beforehand, and then my father and Uncle Fred and Chester McClure and McKinnon, I'm not sure how many of them or who, went up west, and they bought back 4 foxes, 2 pair, in other words. And they paid $8,000 a pair for them back then.
Holy moly.
$8,000 a pair. That's $4,000 a fox. And they got back here. I can just remember this part, them coming with these foxes. And it was night by that time when they got back from up west. And they were afraid to put them out in the ranch because, you know, it's a big ranch. They're all open there and everything. So they kept them in the kitchen all night. And then they took them over to the ranch in the morning and risked their money when they let them go.
Well, that was a fortune.
Oh, yeah.
So you're just a young fellow. So we're talking around 1916 or 17, would it be?
Yeah, in that area, yeah.
So that was a small fortune, wasn't it?
Yeah, but a small fortune then, you know, all those houses in Summerside, they called them fox houses, you know, and most of them were built with 1 or 2 foxes.
Yeah, there's a famous story about the Holman house up there that was traded for 2 foxes, a $9,000 house that they claim.
Yeah, I think I've heard that, too.
I've heard that story, too. Yeah. I've often wondered if it was true, but I think
it is.
Oh,
yeah, it's true. It'd be true. Because I think I have some records somewhere, books around about the fox business back then, but I hadn't thought much about it for a long while. But I can remember that. They paid $8,000 a pair, and they kept them in the kitchen overnight and then took them over there in the morning. And my father, of course, my father and my Uncle Fred, they looked after them. McKinnon and McClure were the, well, perhaps they were the money men behind it, and my father and uncle were doing the work, and the ranch was over there, and I don't know who paid for it or who built it. Well, I don't know who built it. They would have built it, but...
And that would have been expensive, too.
Oh, yes, and of course, not in relation to prices today, but... It would have cost money, all right. So it was quite a chore then. They had they bore a well over there to have water for them because it was too far to get it anywhere else. And so my father would take the feed over used to feed twice a day, and sometimes it was just once, but we had a building next door here where my garage is now, where he used to prepare the feed, and lots of times they ground it up like hamburg type of stuff, and then they'd bought tripe and they bought fish, and we used to fish smelts down below the dam here and catch with a big net. Now, of course, it's illegal. It wasn't then. And we'd put this big net in the hole below where the water dropped down and work it around and pull it out on the flats, and you'd have a cartload. And then we had barrels up along the hedge here and pickled them. And so that they kept there all summer and get them in the spring, and so we could have smelts to feed them all summer.
So that was a constant food, fish of some kind?
Well, yeah, as long as it lasted till the fall. But you didn't feed them completely on smelts. You mixed meat of various kinds. Horse meat was a favorite, too. And tripe from cattle was good food. And anyway, it was ground up and taken over just a little scoop, or mostly in your hand, and throw it out into the pen. You didn't, as a rule, have to go in. You just threw it on the ground, and it didn't stay long. So that was, quite a chore. And then when the spring, when I got older and in later years, then I was helping in the ranch all the time.
Was there someone bringing horses here? Would they? How would people know to bring?
Oh, Well, would they go and? There was places in town that you bought the tripe, for instance, came in boxed in a box from one of the old Davison Frasers was then that killed animals. Right. And no, we never bought horses as such, because this wasn't a big operation really. There'd only be maybe, I suppose, maybe 16 pens over there. But then we branched into putting them in coops, a coop 6 by 10 or 12 feet long. And first it was just to raise the pups then, when they took them away, they put them in these coops. And so that was just mainly the breeding stock that was left out.
How did those first four do?
Oh, well, they did all right, yeah. You had to be very careful then. If there was a silver hair turned up in one of the young foxes or anything, you made sure you pulled it out, because it was the black fox you wanted. No white silver hairs in them. Yet when later it became the silver black fox, but then it was black.
In the early days?
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Strictly black.
Because later I know one of the colors, I think one of the colors was champagne. Was that, am I right?
I've heard the name, yeah.
I think that was a color I remember reading about.
Well, the pelt then, we pelted our own foxes here, and you killed them. You shouldn't say this, I suppose, but the accepted method of killing a fox was just to lay it on the ground or on the floor and put your foot on its ribs right over its heart. Just put your foot there and step on it for only took a couple of minutes and it was dead. Huh. And that may have been just about as good a way as any, So then, of course, you had to skin them, and I did a lot of the skinning of the foxes, and then there was boards was long, narrow, pointed at the top, and you pulled the skin down over that, and the point at the top sort of fit at the head, and they went on tight. And Sometimes they had ones with a split down the middle so you could spread them a little.
That must have been a real knack, I would imagine. You'd had to be careful when you were doing the pelting.
Skinning? Oh, yes, you had to be careful, but, well, there was lots of people who were far better at it than I was, but you split up the four legs, and you did the tail, split the tail, and pulled the tail. The tail was, it would pull right out, you know, it was just like a little small rope. And when you split it right down, then you could get your finger in around it and pull, and you could take the tail right off. And then once you did that, you didn't split it, you just split them across like between the two legs and the tail, and then you got the legs out. And once you got the legs out, then you could just pull the hide right off. It telescoped or folded right over. And, well, you had to use a knife once in a while, but mainly you could just pull it off until you got down to the front legs, and then you pulled them out. They were split too, and you pulled them out and then work it. The careful part really had to be getting it over the head. You know, you had to use a knife around the eyes and that to keep it from spoiling the head.
Because the head was kept on, wasn't it, for some of the coat for the stories?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. Yeah, so you had to be careful in that. But that, and then you put them on these boards, and then they started to dry there, and you had to scrape them with a special scraper so it wouldn't cut into them, and take all the fat off. And when you were right down to the skin, then they were left dry for a certain length of time till they were thought it was safe then to reverse them, and they were inside out then. Mm-hmm. Turn them the other way, and then after that it was a question of selling them. And I've seen people, including my father, going around town, and you run a wire through all the heads, the nose, or the eyes, sort of, to fasten them all together like a loop, and throw that over your shoulder, and you'd have maybe 15, 20 fox pelts hanging over your shoulder here, and going around from one, there'd be different buyers. And you'd go around to see where you could get the best price.
And that was in Charlottetown?
That was in Charlottetown, yeah.
Did you ever take them up to Summerside to sell?
No, we never did.
Always in Charlottetown. Oh,
yeah, the buyers came here at that time, no. Hmm. And, you know, pelts were a pretty good price. Sort of the common run was somewhere between $200 and $400 for a pelt.
And so what would a litter be? What would you save with those first four? What would one of those pair have produced as a litter?
Well, it could be four, sometimes only two, some occasionally just one, or occasionally none, of course. But four was a good litter. And I know I had my older brother. He went out to Michigan. He was he never had a ranch here, but he went out to Michigan and he started a ranch out there. It was the Delta Black Fox Company, too, at first, and then it became Silver and eventually Mink. But anyway, when you ask about how many of a litter, he guaranteed people would buy the foxes from him, and he would guarantee them 100% increase. In other words, you guarantee them two pups. And, of course, the game was then, if somebody only had one or somebody none, sort of everything was pooled. So everybody got their two pups, but sometimes he had quite a few left over for himself, you see.
And because he would keep them and he'd raise them, he'd do all the work himself.
Oh, yeah.
He was selling shares.
Well, it was a big company, eventually. It was a big company. But everybody, you know, it was a pretty good deal. Everybody was guaranteed 100% increase. You don't get that much on your money in most places. So,
no.
It was a good deal then. If he didn't have enough to go around, he'd come back to the island and buy foxes here. And I know we had special crates to put them in, two foxes in a crate about 3 feet long or so, and a square box, and wire on two sides of it or something. And I can remember in our yard here of having, you know, foxes piled up 3 and 4 tier high. He was collecting them, and it was my job to feed them and make sure they were in a shade, and that way they wouldn't get. But he took those back then by train and used them either to sell, to enlarge, or to fill in for the gaps that somebody didn't have too.
And what was that brother's name?
Frank.
That was Frank. So he was spreading the business westward.
Oh, yeah. And then eventually, it became quite a big company out there. And they used to buy their own horses, had their own slaughterhouse and everything, and bought horses and killed them and to feed them. And then when the fox business started going downhill, he was switching over to mink. And they were in mink then for quite a while. But it was big business, real big business. So now what else can we say about...
Did you ever hear of the mother not being able to feed her young and a cat being used?
Oh, yes, we've done that.
You did?
Oh, yeah. We used to have them here, bring them over, and we'd always try to have one or two cats having kittens around that time in the spring when there were foxes were having their litters.
So it was a wet nurse?
Yeah, and they'd take a little fox about yay big and just same as one of their kittens when they were nursing their kittens. And after a day or so, you generally took a kitten away, you know, so the fox would get more milk. But they looked after them just until, we've had them run around the house when they were this big, you know, like a small dog, and run around the house just like pets. And then you'd put them back in the ranch. They'd come right up to you and eat feed out of your hand. So, that was common practice. And people used to, be looking around for somebody that had a cat with kittens, too.
So, as a result, I guess McKinnon and McClure, because didn't McKinnon have ranches somewhere off Mount Edward Road or something?
Oh, no, right up here on where the airport is there now. That was the McKinnon and McClure and McKinnon ranch. And my Uncle Fred then went with them as their head fox man to look after the ranch. They had a big ranch there. So he lived up there. They built a house for him up there and all. And... Yes, they became very big, and my father always kept foxes here, but, not on a big scale.
Well, your father would have dozens, I guess. Does that sound right in the scale that he'd have?
Well, not at one time.
No. Oh, I see.
Well, he'd have dozens. I suppose he'd have about 12 pens over there, and then there were... They got away from using the pens as much as possible and used more of the coops.
And what was the size of the operation up with McKinnon and McClure?
Oh, it was big. Big. I don't know, really. He had a lot of men working up there. And my other brother, older brother, Fred, another brother Fred, Colonel F.I., if most people remembered him as Colonel F.I. Andrew, mm-hmm. He built a ranch up on the hill where all these houses up here, just across on the hill there. We had about 25 acres of orchard up there. And the apple business, it's a hard business. You get a lot of spraying and a lot of work. So he built his ranch in the apple orchard. Huh. And the apple trees, of course, were all lined both ways, and So he put a fence around every apple tree. He had an apple tree in every pen. And surprising how many apples the foxes would eat, too, and they'd drop. You know, they'd like them. They'd eat them.
Isn't that something? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, that's the way he built it, just down on every tree, and it had the shade and all that, see.
Well, that was a darn smart idea, really.
Yeah, he had quite a big ranch up there. And I know we have a picture around here of one time he was an aide to the Governor General at one time, and it was Desborough, I think the governor's name was. And he had him out here when he came to the island. He was out here, and there are pictures of him at the ranch. And so that was about the... Well, pretty well the fox business, you know. You could talk all day about it. But
when did the change? Were you around? Were you old enough to have noticed the change going from black to getting a little bit of silver in?
Oh yes, I say at first it was all black, and I don't know, but it became that they would accept the silver, and then of course people got to like the silver and. They wanted the silver and all over the hips, and you know they looked lovely, and and then there was some foxes, blue fox, that and there was always the old odd one called a husky. It's like any, there could be a dud in a letter, you know, once in a while. And, well, this would be sidetracking a bit, but we had one in our ranch, and my father said to me one day, well, that might as well be your fox there, you can keep it. It was no good anyway. So anyway, it was in the litter. And one time, back in way back then, they used to have a riding club in Charlottetown. It was DeVar's out the North River Road. There was a big place in there, and there was a riding club and a real English type of thing with their riding breeches and dogs and horses and so on, and every fall they'd have these fox hunts, and so it was on the other side of town, but it was an accepted practice. They came through town, and where the hospital is now over there was the Falconwood Farms, and then our land and theirs butted right on together. We used to kind of work back and forth a good bit. Anyway, the fox, in the fall, if you were plowing a field where you knew that that was the route that they took, you see, we got the pond here and the stream down. There's no way getting across but coming up here and crossing our dam, and then they'd go off across, keep going up through Marshfield and so on. But it was sort of an accepted route, and so this time I was plowing a big field of ours back near the river, and so I left a furrow about 20 feet or something like that right up through that I didn't plow, so for the horses when they'd come. So they were having this fox hunt this day, and I wasn't involved in it, but my brother was, and there was about maybe 20 horses, that many, and a lot of dogs. So a fellow that we had working for us here, Chester Smith, he worked for us for years, and he and I were back in the field right alongside that faced on the river too, and we were pulling turnips. And so I heard that they were having this fox hunt that afternoon. So when we were home at lunchtime, I went over to the ranch and I caught this husky fox, all just wool, brown wool. And so I brought it back, and when Chester and I went back to after lunch, we took the fox, had killed it, of course, and took it with us. And so after a while, they always sent a guy ahead dragging the scent, and then for something for the dogs to follow.
So he was actually dragging a fox?
Well, I don't know. He was dragging. I don't think they used something other than a fox, but it could have been a fox, but it wasn't this time, you know. A scent, something with the scent of a fox. Anyway, they came up with this fellow with the dragon, the scent came up through the furrow that I'd left unplowed, and he came right down through our farm and disappeared over here. And so as soon as he went by, Chester and I took this fox, dead fox, up, and we dragged it all around the area where before they went into this lane, and then we went down the hedgerow of the turnip field and down to the river, and it was all marsh there, and threw it out in the marsh. So it wasn't too long, about an hour or so, we heard the other dogs coming, yelping, and all these people on horseback, and so we just laid down between the turnip drills, and so we'd be out of sight, and the dogs came up to this area, and they went clean wild, they were running everywhere, and couldn't find, and then they finally found the scent down towards the river. And so away they go down there, and the other people that didn't know where they were supposed to go, they followed the dogs down to the river and into a bush there and out on the marsh, and so two or three of the horses got stuck in the marsh. Away and came back, got back up, and of course my brother knew where they were supposed to go, and he got them off on the right path. But he knew darn well who did it, because they found this fox. The dogs brought the fox in, and he recognized it quite right away as the fox that that was my fox. So I heard a lot about that, I'll tell you, but it was a great fun. The people that didn't get fall off their horses in the marsh, they thought it was a pretty good joke, too.
But the ones that didn't...
They didn't appreciate it.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that was quite a time. I used to go out to the riding club and to their parties and all that, but I didn't have a riding horse of my own, but my brother had. And so anyway, that's just a sideline from the...
Well, just out of curiosity, what were the breed of horses they'd ride? They wouldn't be riding what you'd call a blood or whatever, would they?
Oh, well, they're all, yeah, light horses. They weren't particularly, you know, long as it's a good...
Yeah.
Mostly... What you call trotting horses and that type of thing.
Yeah. And it was where? It was over on the west side of Charlottetown.
The west side, yeah, and then off the North River Road, Jock Duvars. It's pretty well in off where the Queen Charlotte School is there. There's a big hedge now with a road on each side. There was this great huge trees went in to Duvars' house, and he had a big house in back there.
Yeah, was it called Inkerman, I wonder? Was that the name of the...
No, I believe you're right.
Because there was an Inkerman, I was going to say firm, but that's not right, not to be like a manor house kind of idea.
Yeah, I believe it was Inkerman, though. Yeah. I can't say for sure, but that's
the
that
area,
was
though.
Out there in that area, anyway.
Because that was, at one time, all that area out there was farms and orchards,
oh, yeah,
wasn't it?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Oppenbreiten,
yeah.
Or that area, yeah. Or off there. I'll tell you who told me that was Bob Nicholson, who was the last of the Nicholsons to run Hickey Nicholson's. And he told me that. He showed me a picture of his grandfather standing out in the middle of this field of tobacco. And it was either 1896 or 1906, one of the two, was the years. And he said, now, I'll guess where that field is. And, of course, it was all houses now. And you'd never know to look at it. But that's where they grew a lot of their tobacco, or some of it anyway. It was out that way.
I see.
Yeah.
They grew tobacco?
Yeah.
Right then?
Yeah. His grandfather did, oddly enough, and I was surprised too. I'm sure it was either 1896 or 1906, and there's this man with a big white bushy beard, and it was Bob's grandfather on the Nicholson side. I'm pretty sure on the Nicholson side.
Yeah, that would make sense. Well, that's the tobacco people, of course, that were growing their own.
Yeah.
Well, it was Hickey Nicholson. Hickey was quite a hockey player. He was that family.
Oh, was he? I didn't know that.
And, well, then, of course, there was Cora. She was my age, and I knew her pretty well.
Oh, did you? I see. And what was the Hickey, who was the hockey player named Hickey?
Well, he was some of that family. They lived, their tobacco plant was right there on Prince Street and just below, and they lived in one of the houses right out front there.
Yeah,
he had made quite a name for himself in the hockey, Hickey Nicholson. Oh, he never went NHL or anything like that. But.
Now, just to back you up a little bit to the apple orchard, I'm curious about the varieties of apples. What was being grown back when you were a young fella?
Well, of course, the transparent was very well known and very popular, but they were early apple and wouldn't keep any length of time. There was a lot of them grown. And then there was the red astrakhan and Bishop Pippin and an apple called Spy. But the red astrakhan were one of the favorites because they were pretty good to keep. And this is before the ranch was put in, all this area of apples up there. Well, we had an apple house up there in the middle of it to put apples in, and we used to hire people to come and pick apples. And then my father used to deliver them around Charlottetown with the horse and wagon, big express wagon, and he delivered around to the stores and to houses too. Of course, he did that anyway. Back then, he was running the mill, and he was also delivering flour and meal and oatmeal and stuff like that. So he'd load up the wagon. I'm not sure whether Friday or Saturday. Friday was always market day. I don't think he went then because there was too many other things going on, but I think it was Saturday, but anyways, the end of the week, he always went in, sometimes twice a week. And
he'd go door to door.
Door to door, yep.
Selling bags of apples, I guess it would be, or it'd be.
Yeah, well, whatever people wanted, they'd come out with a dish, you know, some big saucepan or something, and load them up that way, and whatever. Yeah, so he did that a lot, but anyway, then we couldn't sell them all by any means, and then we used to make cider out of them, and. We had a big cider press which ran with an engine, and it was here, sat right over there, and even in this barn until not very many years ago. I gave it to the fellow that has the car museum up towards Borden.
Not McPhail. There's McPhail's out that way, but I know what you mean.
No, it's not
anyway.
A McPhail, but. They were just here in Parkdale, too. I can't think of his name at the moment. But he's got a big place out there yet with antique cars and all that. So I gave it to them because we sat here and we weren't using it anymore.
And so you would, with the mill, the apples would get crushed?
Yeah, well, it was a rig about 4 feet long and about 2 feet wide or so. And there was a big flywheel on one side of it and rollers which meshed together, two rollers as they rolled in towards one another, and there was a hopper above that, and you put the apples in there and the rollers took them through and crushed them, and then the crushed apples dropped down into slatted bins. There were strips with metal around the edge to hold them, and there was no bottom in them or no top. The apples went into, they were sitting on a part of this of the cider press. They were just sitting on the bottom of the smooth bottom there that had a little slant on it too. They dropped into one of those, which was right below the hopper, and when it was full, you moved it to one side and put the empty one there, and while it was filling, there was a big winch, a cover, a false car, loose cover that went on it, and then this big handle would screw down, screw this cover down and press them. And you had some big levers on this, on the winch at the top where you turned it. And you'd press that apples, which were about a foot and a half high, you'd press that down to about 6 inches. And all the juice would run out, of course, and then it ran down and was caught in a bucket at the end where it went over the end. So whenever that, you know, it was a continuous thing. You threw that stuff away and moved the next one in, and you kept her going. And we used to have, we put the cider in 45-gallon barrels, wooden barrels, mm-hmm. and we had them along, just a plank and that to put them on. And, we'd have maybe 20 or 30 barrels of apple juice. It was open then. It wasn't bung down. It was in a bung, in the barrel. And so you left it that way until it started to ferment.
And would it catch yeast out of the air, or am I being stupid there by saying that? Did you ever hear that they would do that and it would catch yeast from the air? There's natural yeast apparently blown around. Because you didn't add anything to it, did
no,
you?
No, I didn't add anything to it.
And just, was the lid off? Or was there a lid on?
No, the lid was on.
Okay, so.
But just a bung holes.
Right.
You know, you poured it in through a big funnel at the top.
Right.
And there'd be a bung about 2 inches or so. So when, as soon as it started to ferment, you could hear it sizzling.
You could.
Then you bunged it down. You put the bung in and drove it in tight. And let it sit then until, well, a year, 2 years. So it got to be hard cider, pretty good stuff. You know, it was, you weren't allowed to sell it if it was over, supposed to be over 2%. You couldn't sell it, but there was a pretty good sale for it.
And so it would probably wind up being about the same alcohol content as beer or something. Would it be around 5? Does that sound...
Well, it would. Yeah, it would. You weren't supposed to sell it that much. They used to come out. I remember one time we had these... used to have these strawberry ice cream festivals. Well, they still do. We're coming back now. And we had one out in the field out here towards the road. And they had a stage for dancing and fiddlers and all that stuff, and sold it as strawberry and ice cream type of thing. And the stage was big enough for people to dance on, and everything was going great until somebody apparently, we had our suspicions at the time, but they got a keg of rum and they had it down in the woods below along the side of the pond there. So they were selling the rum and mixing it with the cider. So things got going pretty well. People were going hooting around and hooray for Johnny Andrews cider. But they were drinking about a quart of rum, I suppose, at the time. We had nothing to do with the rum, but you got the name of it anyway. The next day or two after that, there was some women came around to know if they could get some cider. There's somebody who was sick and they thought that a cider might do them good, and they were just coming to get some so they get it tested. And but there was none left. But anyway, it was, used to have a lot of fun with this cider. So of course it went. We didn't do it anymore then. But to back to when it, all this cider was made, all these barrels, the Miller House, it's still up there. Art Miller lived in it, and Frank, and it's in the Hillsborough development there on the right-hand side. It's a big square yellow house. Perhaps you're familiar with it.
I think I know it.
It's kind of what you call a barrack roof on it. It's a beautiful home built the same architect as Government House. Stairs inside and all that. So, but anyway, it had a wonderful basement, and it was built for this, because they, that land where the orchard went with the house way back. And they had in their basement, it was an 8-foot basement. And they had a ledge along one side about 2 feet high, and that's to put the barrels on. To keep them up and all along, then you could drain them off. They'd turn the bung out, and you know, you could catch it in a bucket or so on. But that's where we stored it, because my father owned the house at that time. He owned the whole Miller place there.
But it was the Miller place before it was your father's?
Yeah. He bought, well, I guess he sold it to the Millers. He bought it, that's the house that, he lived across the road here where what we call the Love House, and, something of
not.
Well, that's who George Wright. Is that on there?
Yeah.
George Wright owned this house up at the head of the pond here. It's now was known for years as the Love House. It's still there and been sold. But George Wright built that house, and when he got married, he married. Cambridge's daughter. Now, Cambridge was a big name back in the 1800s, late 1800s. They built ships down in Murray Harbour and sold them, loaded with lumber and sent them to England and sold them and that type of thing. So their daughter, Phoebe, married George Wright. And they built this house called the Love House, or perhaps they'd built it before that, but anyway, that's where they lived, and the ups the third, there was a third story in it for the servants to live in, and big, huge fireplaces and all that. So, anyway, after that, they lived there for quite a while, and during this period, they built this other house, and they had the same architect that built the Government House design it and all that. And that picture of that house is in the Cummings Atlas. The Meacham's, the old Atlas. Meacham's 1880 Atlas.
That, I think that was John Plaw, was it? Was John Plaw the architect of Fanning Bank?
I'm not sure.
I think it was. I can't remember. I remember I was at a lecture one time and his name was mentioned for that. But anyway.
It wasn't Harris.
I don't think it was Harris. I think it's before him.
Well, anyway, that's the same fellow. So they had this house built, and they moved into it, and they gave this one. No, I'm wrong. When they got married, the Cambridges owned, there was a mill down here called the Bird Isle Mill at that time, below our dam, and 600 acres of land. And they gave it over to George Wright and Phoebe and the Mills, which were down here, as a wedding gift.
That was from the Cambridges?
From the Cambridges. They were in business. They went in business together for a while, you know, building ships and all that. But, things didn't go too smoothly, probably. And Wright wanted his own business, so Cambridge turned it over to them. And then they later built we call it, now referred to it as the Miller House, but it was Wright's house.
Well, was this house here then, back in those days, or was this after?
Well, not the way there's been a lot added to it, But the original house is still incorporated in this one, and we have pictures taken just after. Well, the original mills burned in 1810, and we have pictures just after that, and they built the new mill, and this house was here then. Wow. But it was just a plain rectangular house, and not very big, and it wasn't, but it was a good house.
But still, there was something here about 40 years ago.
The mills were in full bloom and operation here. There was a grist mill where they ground flour and oatmeal and crushed grain for cattle. And then there was a big kiln for drying oats. To make oatmeal, you have to dry the oats. So I could tell you all about that. And then the other mill, that mill ran with a steel turbine. There was 20 feet of water pond there, still is, I guess. And it was a round tank, round cylindrical tank below the dam, and a steel wheel in the bottom of that. And a shaft came up through to the top, and there was a big pulley horizontal on the top. And the belt went in through to another stack of pulleys, which went right down through the mill. And each on each level, there was two or three pulleys, and they all ran a different piece of equipment, and they all had their own belt going off. So that wheel ran that mill unless there wasn't enough water. And when there wasn't enough water, they had a big steam engine in it. And they could switch over and run with steam, because there was another mill right alongside on the same dam. And it was a carding mill, and there was two sets of cards in that, and a machine for purling barley, and a small sawmill for their own use mostly. But the carding wool was the big thing, and it was run by a wooden overshot water wheel. Now, for one that didn't know, overshot water wheel is all built out of wood, or mostly. And it has buckets on it, and a flume comes in and drops water, and it drops them into these buckets, and the weight turns the wheel, and they get down to the bottom, they empty out and come up the other side. In the meantime, there's this continuous flow of water. So that was that wheel, overshot water wheel. You can't have them what they call undershot, which goes in underneath, but the overshot is much better because it's got all that weight on it. So that mill ran by that wheel, overshot water wheel.
And when you mentioned purling barley, what's that?
Well, it takes the, what you might say, it takes the hull off the barley. And when you buy barley, it's, small. So that's what does that. And it was just a big drum affair, about 4 feet across and about 18 inches deep, I think. And the there was metal on both sides of it, heavy metal. And the metal was all, it's like you went over the outside of it with a big spike and a hammer and drove holes in it and pushed the burrs in. So then when the feed came in, of course, I'm forgetting the main thing was in there. There was a stone, a big granite stone similar to a millstone, only it ran on its edge perpendicularly inside of this. So you put the barley in the top, and it went down through, and this wheel stone was spinning, and it was hitting it against the bird sides, and that's what did the work, and it came out the bottom eventually.
And then you could make scotch broth.
Yeah, you could make anything you wanted with it after that. So, but that, I don't quite know why that wasn't in the grist mill with the other stuff, but that's where it was. Probably it may have been built later or something, but that's where it was. And then, of course, down below the dam, there was a brewery. And they made beer down there. And the cellar of that brewery is still down there. You can still see the end. When I was a kid, we used to go down there and finding bottles, various types of bottles that they used. But when the mills burned in 18, some dispute whether it's 10 or 13, but it was right after the Wrights took the place over from the Cambridges, it burned. And so they didn't rebuild the brewery, because back in those days, people didn't drink much beer. They all drank rum. It was the big thing. So the brewery wasn't making any money, so they didn't rebuild it. There's a piece in that Island magazine. One of the magazines is almost totally filled with stories about the brewery down there. Yeah.
That would be George Wright might have had something to do with that. Was it George Wright, the one?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, he's the same.
Yeah, he's the same clan, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
Was there, when your father ran the mills, were all the mills operating when your dad? Did your father ran the carding and the grist and the and the shingle or the sawmills?
Well, the sawmill wasn't for public. It's just when they wanted lumber, they sawed it. You know, it wasn't a public mill. It was. They ran, you know, at their sawmills, there's a table and they put the log on and it goes up and so on. This one down here was smaller and they just cranked the table in by hand into the saw. And so it was really for their home use.
Your father was a busy man then. If he was running a firm plus those mills, and then he was going to town and also peddling.
Yeah, and then what the kicker was then, when the foxes got going, he was too busy. And the foxes was the easier thing to do, and they let the mills slide. And also, just at that time, they were getting out of the stone ground flour and going into what they called the roller process, which gave you white flour and everybody thought that that's what you had to have. Now they're getting back into the grain flours again. But at that time, so it would have been a big operation to change the mill over. So he never did that. We got stones around here, millstones. There's one down there by the pond, and one in front of our house there. Those stones weigh about a ton apiece, and they all came from the Isle of Skye.
Did they really?
Yeah. Isle of Skye, granite.
Is there really? Oh. Well, just out of curiosity, what's your family ancestry? Are you Scots?
Yeah,
you must be.
Yeah.
Not from Skye, though. I mean, that would be too much of a coincidence, wouldn't it?
Well, no, we're not from Skye, but my wife's side of they came from the Isle of Skye.
McLeod?
Mathesons.
Oh, Mathesons, right.
Yeah. But they're the Isle of Skye.
Well, isn't that interesting, though, that here's little bits and pieces of Skye lying around your property?
Well, our ancestors came from... they have a history, family history of them, you know. Some of the younger generations are getting right into it, and they have it all on paper. But it's all from Scotland and between... Oh, not too far from Glasgow, in that area.
When you were a young fellow, you mentioned that there was little bits and pieces of the brewery left down there.
Yeah, and just mostly bottles. And
right.
Because it burned completely. Well, I say it burned, that would be 1813, we'll say. And then it was rebuilt right away. And...
But the mills didn't burn.
Oh, yes.
Oh, they did, too.
Everything burned. Everything burned.
But the mills were rebuilt.
The mills were rebuilt, yeah.
And now there's none of the mills left?
No. I tore the mills down after the war. Well, they were falling down.
Yeah.
You couldn't... We used to spend days every spring down there, because they were built on quite a slope on the hill, and they'd always keep sliding a little down the hill, and then you had to put in all new posts because they weren't. Well, originally there was just a concrete wall put across the front, like, and then the rest was all on posts. And down at the water, on the water side, right where the water wheel was here, and the side of the mill that was there, it was all mud, marsh mud or mud. And what carried that was a mud sill. And that was a great huge hemlock tree, which was taken out of the woods across the pond there. And it would be nearly two feet, I guess, and it was flattened on two sides with a broad axe, you know, mm-hmm. that they used by hand. And that was bedded on, just put on top of the mud. And then you put your posts on top of that, and that was the sill. And it's surprising that, well, if you dig down deep enough down there yet, that mud sill is still there. We never took it out.
Good heavens. So the mills more or less stopped operating in the 30s, does that sound about right?
Yeah, before that, really. Well, yeah, just about the 30s. It was in the 20s the fox business was going good, and roller process was coming in, so the mills were let go. We used to use them for ourselves, for crushing feed and so on, but eventually the flumes going in were a big thing to keep up. It was all a big box, fair open top.
And they'd have to be watertight.
Well, it should be, but they were, it's hard to keep them. They were just a square-edged plank, and like building a boat, you know, and corked. So when you turned the water on, it was nearly half the water was squirting out, and the other half was feeding the wheel to run the mill.
You must remember people coming, though, with their grist, do you?
Oh, yes, yeah. That's why this, across the pond on the other side there's a walking trail there. Well, it's a road, but it's used now. People walk on it all the time. They think it's part of the public trail, but it's not. But anyway, that's always called and referred to as the Mill Road, because back then all the traffic came in across over there down to the mill. And if you were coming, there was no road out here at all. And if you were coming up here, you crossed the dam and come up into the yard here. So that's what everybody went down there. And if you had a grist of whatever, could be wheat or grain to get crushed for cattle or whatever, and there was no money changed hands at the mill at all, it was weighed, the grist was weighed, and there was a scoop. It had a wooden back in it and a handle which was wood, which stuck out the back, and the metal scoop went out, and it was a certain size. It was an official toll scoop. So that if you had, 400 pounds of grain, whatever type of grain it was, it required the miller could take so many scoops for toll. And that he had to use that scoop, and he'd scoop it out and put it into his own box or bag that was there. And that's how he got paid. And when he got enough of his own, then he ground that and took it to town on a Saturday afternoon and sold it.